You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's show is sponsored by Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market is turning 30 and has partnered with some of its favorite friends for 30 days of Twitter giveaways. Follow at Whole Foods NYC and use the hashtag WFMNYCBday to qualify and win prizes from Brooklyn Salsa Company, Rick's Picks, Gus Soda, Housing Works, the New York Botanical Garden, and more. Welcome to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. I'm an instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York. And you are listening to this show on heritageradionetwork.com, hopefully, or maybe you've podcasted it on iTunes. Either way, glad that you're listening. Well, here we go. It's the official last week of summer. Even though it's not the calendar version, I know September 21st is technically the last true day of summer. But doesn't Labor Day weekend always really feel like the last day of summer? Even though I've been out of school now for more than 20 years, out of college for almost 20 years, I still get September back to school anxiety. I still get that anxious feeling that it's all going to come crashing to an end and the yellow school bus is going to drive up. And I hate that. I hate that. Even though I'm a little sick of this hot weather that's suddenly come back, I still have the back to school anxiety that, you know, I have to go get the new crayons and face the new year. One summer about, I guess, 10 years ago, I did a share house on Fire Island. And it was great. If you've never been to Fire Island, it's a beautiful place with no cars and beautiful beaches. And it was like the land of endless summer. I used to say the Fire Island was full of Peter Pans because it was just full of adults who refused to grow up and wanted to play on the beach for the rest of their lives. And we would stay out there on weekends almost till Halloween, like almost until the end of October, just trying to squeeze every little last drop out of summer fun times on the beach, even though the days were getting shorter and colder and it was obviously the end of summer. We were determined to make it last, no matter what. And that's sort of how I feel, you know, like you got to make it last. The calendar may say it's the end, but squeeze it out. And New York stays summer hot well through September anyway. I mean, it's 96 degrees today, so I don't think it's going anywhere soon, although apparently there's a hurricane coming. I just heard about that. But anyway, also many years ago, I worked as the sous chef in a summer resort in Maine, a resort hotel in Maine. And it was only open for the season, which in Maine is basically mid-June to the end of August. Before mid-June in northern Maine, there could still be snow on the ground. And if there wasn't snow, there was mud. And it was too much mud to have guests come in and get down the road. Sometimes there'd still be snow on the ground when we got up there, like in late May. And it was also so far north that by this week, this would be the last week of the season, the leaves on the maple trees would be turning red already. And the farm stands would have pumpkins for sale, which was always kind of strange. And so I would, you know, and sort of as sad as I was for these glorious Maine summers to end and that I had to leave, I would also get that kind of invigorated autumn energy that I love too. I mean, here I am whining about summer ending, but I do love fall too. And it would feel like fall. There'd be pumpkins and maple leaves and we'd be wearing fleece and wool sweaters in the morning. And, you know, it was chilly. You'd smell wood smoke in the evening. You know, it was like being in the L.L. Bean catalog. It was very classic New England stuff. And you'd think, ooh, it's fall. And then I'd come back to New York at Labor Day and it would be 90 degrees for another 2 weeks. So it all depends on where you are, I suppose. And, you know, then suddenly that weather was over and it was Halloween and then it's Christmas and there you go. So the seasons are fleeting. What am I getting at? Seasons are fleeting. And even after, you know, 40 plus years of experiencing them, it still gets to me how quickly things can change and how you have to make the most of it while you have it. So here's to enjoying it while it lasts and squeezing out every last drop of what's left of this summer. And on that theme today, we're kind of picking up where I left off during the week. I was a guest this past week on All Things Considered on WNYC, which is New York Public Radio. I'm not sure if it's going to air nationally or just locally, but it's airing this Friday. And I don't know what time, but I will post the time on the Why We Cook Facebook page as soon as I know. But anyway, I was on as a guest to talk about peaches because I had been doing these shows about fruit because they're doing a series called Last Chance Foods. And Last Chance Foods isn't about things that are going extinct. It's about foods that are in season right now, but you better hurry up and eat as much as you can of them right now because in a few more weeks, that's it. No mas. They're gone. So I was on to talk about peaches and about how fleeting they are in their perfect state. And they're doing a bunch of them. They did one on peppers that same day. I know because in the green room, I ran into Seamus Mullen, Chef Seamus Mullen, formerly of Boca Ria. And he had just done a show on peppers. And Heritage Radio's own Kathy Irway did a segment, too, on cranberry beans a few weeks ago. So if you like her show, you could check out her segment on the WNYC culture page. But one thing they haven't done one on, I don't think, is sweet corn. And sweet corn is also one of those end of summer fleeting foods that we probably get about, I don't know, a 6-week season, maybe from like mid-July till the first frost. And then that's it. So this week on Why We Cook, it's the Summer Sweet Corn Send-Off Spectacular. So this weekend, this past weekend, I had some guests up at my teeny tiny little bungalow in the country where I spend my summer weekends. And so, of course, I had to make dinner for everybody, which I usually do, not just when I have guests. It's actually the only place I really cook is at the tiny bungalow. And I was putting it all together, and I was kind of looking at, you know, what I had foraged and purchased and grown to make dinner. And I realized that it was actually pretty close to a 100-mile dinner. You know, if you've ever read that book, The 100-Mile Diet, or, you know, that's sort of what locavores strive for, right? And then maybe it was closer to like 300-mile dinner, but some of it was like a 10-foot dinner because the herbs and the tomatoes came from right outside my door in the garden. Now, I was using olive oil, which came from like 3,000 miles away. But if I had grown a pig myself and killed it and used the bacon fat, then I could have not used the olive oil. But you're not allowed to have pigs in the neighborhood. But everything else was pretty local. Like, you know, the cucumbers, the green beans were from the farmer's market. The mackerel was Atlantic mackerel. And of course, I had to serve sweet corn because it's sweet corn season. And that was local sweet corn. And it's been a really great year, I think, for corn. Even with that drought we've had, maybe that helped it. But it's been a really good corn year. And we've been eating corn every week for probably the past 3 or 4 weeks. And it's been really sweet and really crunchy and juicy. I know the sweetness has to do with genetic engineering, and I'll get to that later in the show. But it's been really good corn this year. And so when it's that good, you know, to cook it, it's like a minute in the water. I really just blanch it. And that's it. Or throw it on the grill for a couple minutes and it gets kind of charred and smoky like the Mexican grilled corn that the vendors sell at the Red Hook Ball Fields, if you've ever been down there in Brooklyn. I love that stuff. And sweet corn is such an iconic summer food to me. It's like one of those symbols of summer, like watermelon, you know. But it's only good when it's really good. It's one of those things like a bad peach, like a bad tomato. Why bother? If it's not good, it can be really starchy and mealy and bad when it's bad. But when it's great, it's great. And when I was a youngster, when I was a child growing up on rural Long Island, the variety of corn we used to buy at our local market was called sugar and butter corn. I think that's what it was called. Because it was white and yellow inside, it was bicolor corn. But it wasn't like the hybrid sugar queen kind of varieties that we get now that stay super sweet or ever sweet. This was corn that, like, it had to be picked and then you had to cook it right away because as soon as you picked it, the sugars would start to convert to starch and it would lose its sweetness. So you had to pick the corn. Well, we didn't pick it. You had to go to the farm stand, buy the corn, run home, cook it that night, or it was over. Because cooking it would stop that conversion from happening. We have to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about corn even more. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's show is brought to you by Whole Foods. That's some scary music we're playing on the show these days. Please don't think that that music represents the taste of the host. Maybe that's the sound of the sugar converting to starch in the corn. I don't know, but it scared me. Anyway, welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. We're talking about sweet corn today. And I was talking about how when we used to buy corn on Long Island when I was a kid, you had to get it into the pot as soon as you could because the sugars would convert to starch very quickly. But doing some research this morning, of course, I knew that modern hybrids, modern cultivars of corn, you don't have to worry about that as much. It doesn't happen as quickly. It still happens, but it doesn't happen as quickly. And as I was kind of looking around doing some reading, I came upon this list of names of sweet corn varieties, and I found the sugar and butter, which I had grown up on, but I also found a whole drag cabaret show's worth of names, or maybe it was the cast of like a stripper review, but ladies and gentlemen, here they are, the Niblets, starring the cast: Sugar Buns, Bodacious, Honey and Cream, By Queen, Platinum Lady, Pearl White, and Silver Queen. All innocent names of simple ears of corn. Or are they? Sounds to me like the people naming the varieties of corn may be interested in some other activities. I'm just saying. So, if you read anything by Michael Pollan or other contemporary writers on food policy or food politics in America today, you probably know that America is a corn-fed nation. If you saw Food Inc., if you saw King Corn, if you read Fast Food Nation, any of those books, very important, significant books, you know that the American diet is just completely based on corn. It's everywhere, insidiously creeping into our lives in the form of animal feed for animals who never evolved to eat corn, were never designed to eat corn like cattle. High fructose corn syrup, processed cornstarch products, snack food, junk food. I mean, we are completely corn-fed creatures. But all of that stuff is made from field corn, not sweet corn. So you don't have to feel bad about eating sweet corn. Not that you would, but, you know, I tend to feel bad about things like that. You don't have to feel bad about eating sweet corn because sweet corn is different. It's special and it deserves to be eaten and it deserves to be loved. Sweet corn is a spontaneous genetic variation of field corn. Field corn is what the animals get fed and gets turned into Fritos and Doritos and corn syrup and all that crap and all that bad stuff. But sweet corn is it's a mutation. It occurred naturally in that field corn, and it was eaten by the Iroquois, the Native American tribes of upper New York State and the Great Lakes. And it was introduced to Europeans in the late 1700s. So sweet corn is good. Field corn is bad. They're all corn, but one's good, one's bad. So sweet corn, difference is, you know, obviously there are these varieties that are sweet, but it's picked when it's fresh and soft, and they call that the milk stage. And if you've ever cut into fresh corn, you see that it's milky. And that's actually how you know that your sweet corn is going to be good. You pop a kernel of it, and it should be milky on the inside, not doughy and not watery. You're looking for milk. Field corn, or dent corn, as it's known as too, is picked when it's dry. So they let it dry out in the fields, and then it's picked. If you let sweet corn dry out in the field and then picked it, and then you cooked it in oil, you would have corn nuts. You know those corn nuts things? I never knew how they made them. That's what they are. Popcorn, on the other hand, is a whole different variety of corn that's allowed to dry in the field too. It's not sweet corn or dent corn. It's a different kind of corn. But anyway, because sweet corn is picked when it's still wet and milky, it can't be stored for very long. Like I was saying earlier, the sugars convert to starches, but the most commonly grown varieties now can be held longer than the old-fashioned ones that had to be cooked right away. But any storing of sweet corn for long periods of time is still going to destroy it. You know, like in the supermarket, maybe they don't have it anymore, but I remember, like, there'd be like a cardboard tray with three ears of corn that had been husked and the ends had been chopped off, so they were all the same length, and then it'd be shrink-wrapped, and it was old and terrible, and they'd sell it in the winter. I mean, why bother? Why even sell that? Just eat it now when it's good. It's a last-chance food, to quote Amy Eddings on WNYC. It's a last-chance food, so eat it now when it's good, and then just forget about it until next summer. Don't eat it again. Don't think about it. No frozen corn, no canned corn. If you have to, you could eat those, but just wait. Wait for it to come back. The sugar in corn really quickly turns to starch, like I said. It loses its flavor, its quality, but most of all, it loses its sweetness. So if you do buy it and you have to store it, you want to put it in a perforated plastic bag. Get it in your fridge as soon as possible. Chilling it down will slow down the process. Warm temperatures just speed up that conversion process, and try to use it within a day or two of cooking, because otherwise, turns starchy. And don't husk it until you're ready to use it either. I know you want to save space, but keep the husk on. It's there to protect it. It's like its little protective jacket. And since we're talking about corn and this is a cooking show, if you listen to this show regularly, if you've listened in the past, you may have heard me speak my mind about certain subjects, and one of them is the raw foods movement, whatever it's called. And you may have noticed that I'm a big opponent of the whole raw foods movement. Now, it doesn't mean I'm opposed to salads, raw fruit, sushi. I like raw things too. But this show is called Why We Cook. It's not called Why We Don't Cook. And I'm here to talk to you about cooking. The idea of eating everything raw completely flies in the face of what theorists say made us human, what anthropologists say have made us human, and it's what separated us from the primates. And we learned to cook, and therefore it gave us the advantage as a species. We got bigger brains, we stood up, we stopped spending all day chewing, and it gave us this capacity to think great thoughts and do things like invent language and cars and iPods and sneakers and now ruining our planet. But that's another show. So yes, some foods are definitely better for you when they're raw and in their pure forms. And I agree with that. But a lot of foods are more nutritionally available to you when they're cooked. And sweet corn is one of them. Sorry, raw foods people. Haha, it's better for you when it's cooked. Now, when you cook it, you do destroy some of the vitamin C in it, but you're getting plenty of vitamin C from other places. Sweet corn has something in it called ferulic acid, which is now known to be a very powerful cancer preventative. When you cook the corn, you release the ferulic acid, and you're gaining in that. And sweet corn is a very high antioxidant, and you're increasing that too. So you can eat it raw if you want. And actually, sometimes when it's really, really sweet and great, I do. I eat it raw. But don't be afraid to cook it either. Just cook it briefly. Sweet things get sweeter with cooking most of the time. Not always. We have to take another quick break. When we come back, a little more about corn. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's show is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Welcome back to Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Erica Wides, your host. And if you're a fan of Why We Cook, you can visit us. Please visit us on Facebook. Just search for Why We Cook on Heritage Radio Network on Facebook. I would love to hear from you. And you can also leave comments on the heritageradionetwork.com website. There's a page for each show. Please leave comments. I would love to hear from you there, too. So we were talking about corn, and we were talking about sweet corn in the previous segment. And I was also talking about field corn. And field corn, of course, is that stuff that all the bad stuff is made out of, corn syrup and Fritos, Cheetos, all that animal feed. But they do also use that to make good things like cornmeal and polenta and grits. So it's not all bad. But it's sort of bad, some of it. And I was thinking about about polenta this morning as I was writing this. And, you know, polenta's great. It's cornmeal mush. It's good stuff. But then it reminded me of something I ate last week. Now, if you are a dedicated listener of this show, and I know you are, or if you podcast it even occasionally, you may remember another show that I did a while back. I would say maybe 6 months back or so. And it was called The Worst Plate Ever. Do you remember that show? Well, in that show, I regaled you with tales of a practical exam that I had given while teaching at ICE a few years ago. And during that practical exam, I was presented with the most inedible, most non-food-like plate of food I had ever encountered in all my years of teaching, of eating. This was the worst thing I had ever been given on a plate. So you should go to iTunes and podcast that one and listen to it. It's called Worst Plate Ever. But last week, I may have gotten the second worst plate ever. And the reason I remember that is because of the polenta. Now, this plate in no way comes even close to the first one. The first one was inedible. This one was just weird and wacky and out there and comical. And I'm still trying to figure out what made it happen. But in the terrible practical exam Hall of Fame, the first one is to, you know, it's like the Stanley Cup of plates. This one is more like, I don't know, what's less important than the Stanley Cup? I don't know. The ping pong tournament, world championships or something. I don't know. Depends how you feel about sports. I don't really know sports. Not good with the metaphors. Anyway, but this plate was made by a student who in all other ways is like a lovely, sweet guy. Just a really nice guy, good student. He's a good team worker. He's motivated. He's focused. He's so nice. But I don't know what happened on this practical exam. He went off in a direction that is not even on the map. I mean, he's a smart guy. He wants to open his own restaurant. I don't know. But so the practical exam that I was giving, it was the final for the end of the program. And here's what they get. They get a chicken. They get a whole chicken. And I got organic chickens because I didn't want to have to taste 16 industrial chickens. So they each get a chicken. And then they each get assigned a vegetable and a starch. And they have to do a dish with that. They have to make a sauce. Also, the sauce has to be a stock-based sauce, a chicken stock-based sauce. And then there's this whole huge list of other ingredients. They get all this other stuff, all these different herbs and condiments and all these other vegetables. I mean, we give them a ton of stuff. We give them too much to work with, really. I think it throws them off their game because it's too much. But I like to narrow it down. They get one chicken. They each get a starch. They each get a vegetable. They have to make a sauce. And I'm pretty specific about what they have to do. Or at least I thought I was specific. What I want them to do is I want them to fabricate the chicken, which means break it down. I want them to leave the breast whole. They have to do a whole intact chicken breast, boneless chicken breast. And they have to also use the leg and the thigh meat somewhere on the plate. So I don't want just a plate with a cooked chicken breast and a sauce. I want the cooked chicken breast with the sauce. I want them to leave it whole. It can be sliced, but it needs to be intact. Whatever they want to do with the leg and thigh meat is fine. The smart student who's been paying attention for the last 105 lessons at that point will remember that the breast meat of chicken is really lean and tender and can be very dry. And the leg and thigh meat has a lot more fat and is a little bit tougher and can withstand longer cooking. So if they've been paying attention at all, like I said, for the last 105 lessons, they would know that the breast should probably just be like sauteed or seared gently, finished in the oven, served with a sauce. And the leg and thigh could be braised or it could be roasted or stewed or whatever you want to do with it because it's more indestructible. And most of them got that concept. And most of them presented me with that. But not this guy. So it was his time to present. And I was watching them as they were cooking, and I noticed early on that he had taken one of the breasts and he had cut it up into tiny little dice. And I got scared at that point. I didn't know what was going on. But I thought, okay, they have a whole chicken. There's two breasts on the chicken. Maybe he's just making a stuffing or something. I gave him the benefit of the doubt. And then at some point, I saw him cutting open a baguette, because we have baguettes in the room. And I thought, okay, maybe he's just having a snack. And then I saw him spreading something yellow on that baguette. And from where I was sitting, it looked like cheese. And I was like, is he making me a cheese sandwich? Is he having a snack? Is that chicken fat? What is that? So he brings the plate to me. And here's what's on the plate. There was a probably 6-inch length piece of split open toasted baguette. On that baguette was about a 1/4-inch thick layer of polenta. The polenta was being used as a spread. This is where we're tying back into the corn theme, by the way, if you think I've lost it here. The polenta was used as a spread on the bread. His assigned starch was polenta. His assigned vegetable was cauliflower. The polenta had not been really cooked. It had been mixed with some liquid and cooked briefly to hydrate, but it wasn't really cooked. So it was sort of the consistency of like mixed cement, wet cement that hadn't set yet. It was in kind of a flowing mush form, but the individual grains were still crunchy and hard. So that was spread on the bread. Sitting on top of the polenta spread was about a 6-inch long by 3-inch wide patty made from diced up chicken breast that had been mixed together with ground up bread as breadcrumbs, some eggs, and I don't know what else. Now, when you make a patty out of a protein, or you make like a forcemeat, which is basically what that is, you don't use the lean, white, tender parts of it. You use the darker, fattier parts of it because they'll give you some substance and some fat to hold it together and to give it flavor. You don't grind up the chicken breast and do it that way. So basically, he had made me a giant chicken McNugget, served it on a slab of basically uncooked polenta, put it all on top of a toasted baguette, and then put it on the plate with 4 little florets of cold boiled cauliflower, and then the chicken leg. There was no thigh in sight, but the leg was on the plate, and the leg had been maybe roasted. I can't even remember. It was sort of barbecued. And so the lone little leg was just kind of sitting there. And then there was a little ramekin filled with sauce. So he had made some kind of like cornstarch thickened sauce. It was sort of like a gravy. It was cold. And he presented it to me, and I said, "What is this?" And he said, It's like a big chicken McNugget. And I said, "Yeah, that's what it is." I said, "What's the little ramekin?" He said, "Well, it's sort of like a French dip, and you can dip the chicken sandwich into the ramekin." Unfortunately, we are out of time, so I can't really tell you how it all went over, but I think you can imagine that he didn't quite get the grade that some of the other students got. I really had to give it to him, though, for creativity, although this wasn't really a creative practical. It's not exactly what I was looking for. But no one's ever given me a gigantic chicken McNugget patty on a slab of uncooked polenta before. So he goes into the practical exam hall of fame underneath that notorious worst plate ever. Anyway, we're out of time. So thanks for listening, and have a good Labor Day, and we'll see you soon.